Last time we were taking a look at King Hezekiah and the fact that once he secured the position of being king of Judah in his own right following the death of his father, that he began to do that which was right in God's sight, and he held this great Passover, even inviting people who had remained of the northern kingdom to come down and join him with that observance. And that by doing this and by getting rid of the worship of Hadad-Rimmon, which was the feature of Assyrian religious worship that had been enforced as part of the vassalage to which Judah had been reduced on his father's day, that that was an act of rebellion, as well as the fact that he withheld the normal tribute payment. And so King Sennacherib came to punish Hezekiah and fulfilled the prophecy that we found in Isaiah chapter 8, where he overflowed the entire country, and it said it would reach even until the neck, meaning up until the capital city. Now if we turn in 2 Kings to chapter 18, we find that this was a very difficult time for Hezekiah. 2 Kings 18, we can begin in verse 13. In the 14th year of King Hezekiah, which would be 701 BC, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and took them. And as I say, it was the fulfillment of that prophecy of Isaiah chapter 8. Then Hezekiah, the king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria at Lachish. It's interesting that we have recovered from the palace of Sennacherib a very beautiful bas-relief depicting his siege to the city of Lachish and his conquest of it. Very extensive bas-relief. It's now in the British Museum. There's a copy of it in the Israel Museum. And it also, when they've dug at Lachish, they have found the remains from that siege. One of the more interesting things they found is that the Assyrians built a siege ramp up against the tell so they could bring their battering rams in and knock down the walls. And the defenders of the city were raising a counter ramp, you might say. They were trying to raise the level of the wall higher so that the Assyrians would have to change the angle of their ramp. And if they could get that defensive rampart, really is what they were building, an earthen rampart, a defensive rampart, if they could have gotten it built high enough, fast enough, they would have forced the Assyrians to produce a ramp, a siege ramp, of such an angle that the battering ram on it would be useless. That was their main hope for survival. And you could just picture the desperation with which they were working, trying to get this rampart built in time and high enough so the Assyrians would be unable to use their battering rams. Well, it didn't work. They lost the race with time. And you can, when you go there, you can still see the remains of that rampart that they were building. It's sometimes seeing things like that sort of recapture the sense of the time and the emotions that undoubtedly were felt by the people that were living at that time. At least that was the way it struck me, and I know it struck Mr. Suckling the same way. So he was at Lachish conducting the siege there, and Hezekiah sent a message to the king saying, "I have done wrong. Turn away from me. Whatever you impose on me, I will pay." And the king of Assyria assessed Hezekiah, the king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. Now Hezekiah was driven by desperation. He had done that which was right in God's sight. And yet God had seemingly abandoned him. He had allowed the king of Assyria to come and conquer all of his major cities. And so he figured it's useless to resist. I will submit. And this was the penalty that the king of Assyria laid on him. And so as it says in chapter 8, 2 Kings 18, verse 15, "So Hezekiah gave him all the silver that was found in the house of the Eternal and in the treasuries of the king's house." Now it's interesting it mentions the silver specifically from that, which was money that was private money, remember, on deposit in the temple. He sort of expropriated the wealth of the wealthy people for this national emergency, as well as, of course, contributed his own wealth. Then it says, at that time, Hezekiah stripped the gold from the doors of the temple of the Eternal and from the pillars which Hezekiah, the king of Judah, had overlaid and gave them to the king of Assyria. Now, the king of Assyria, this king being Sennacherib, left a record of this particular invasion of Judah, and he records having taken all these cities, and he records having received this tribute payment from Hezekiah. Interesting confirmation of this particular biblical passage. But that still wasn't enough for Sennacherib. When he got the message from King Hezekiah, he sent back the message, well, you have to send me so much silver and so much gold, as if, well, that'll take care of it. We could call it quits then. And so Hezekiah sends the silver and gold, and then Sennacherib ups the ante. Change my mind. That's not enough. You see, now that I've got your money, I'm going to want more. So, in verse 17, the king of Assyria sent, now in the New King James it says, the Tartan, the Rapsaris, and the Rapshaka. What does it say in the original King James? Takes the word the out. You see, when they originally translated the records, the Hebrew, they thought those were personal names. They were the names of three top officials that Sennacherib sent up to Jerusalem. But as we've uncovered ancient documents from Assyria, we have learned the titles that were given to high officials of the Assyrian court. And we found that Tartan was a title of a high official of the Assyrian court, that Rapsaris was a title, and the Rapshaka was another title. So we don't know who these people were by name. But in other words, Sennacherib stayed down there at Lachish to supervise the culmination of the siege and the capture of the city, but he sent the three top officials of his court to Jerusalem to parley with Hezekiah. He also sent a great army that was to back up his demands. They went up and came to Jerusalem. When they came up, they came and stood by the aqueduct from the upper pool, which is on the highway to the fuller's field. And when they had called to the king, you know, they stood there below the walls of the city, yelling up, you know, we're here to parley. So when they had called to the king, Eliakim the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, Shebna the scribe, and Yoah the son of Asaph the recorder, came out to them. And that's exactly what you would expect. You have three top officials coming from the Assyrian king. You have the three top officials of the Jewish court coming out to, you know, conduct an equal parley here. These are their opposite numbers, if you will, that are coming out to discuss the affairs. Then the Rabshakeh said to them, speak to Hezekiah. Thus says the great king. Interestingly enough, this is exactly the way Assyrian kings in their own records describe themselves. They describe themselves by that specific title, great king. Interesting that the Bible records that flavor. Thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, what confidence is this in which you trust? In other words, why is the city locked up as against a siege? Who do you expect to deliver you from our hands? I mean, nobody stands against the Assyrians. We just don't lose. I mean, what are you trusting in? Where are you getting this confidence from? You speak of having counsel and strength for war, but they're vain words. In whom do you trust that you rebel against me? Now look, you're trusting in the staff of this broken reed Egypt, and on which if a man leans, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, to all who trust in him. Now apparently Hezekiah had relied on military help from the Pharaoh of Egypt. And the Pharaoh of Egypt had even invaded Palestine, coming up the Via Maris. And when he saw the might of the Assyrian forces and tested them a little bit, he turned tail very quickly and went running home. He decided, oops, I bit off more than I could chew here. Forget it. Let Hezekiah sink in his own mess. I'm getting out while the getting is good. So you might say, Sennacherib is sort of rubbing it in for Hezekiah. You know, you thought that you'd get some benefit from a military alliance with the king of Egypt. Well, look what a kind of a broken reed he's proved to be. Are you still trusting that he's going to raise a larger army and come back and rescue you? Forget it. He may be raising a larger army, but that's to protect himself in case I decide to go down there after I finish with you. So if that's what you're trusting in, that's ridiculous. But if you say to me, we trust in the Eternal, our God, how can you depend on this God that you claim is so marvelous? Because isn't that the same God whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah has taken away, saying to Judah and Jerusalem, you shall worship before only this altar in Jerusalem? See, Hezekiah had done away with a lot of the altars that existed throughout the country. And in fact, when we visited the city of Arad, we found that the city, Israelite city of Arad, in the, you know, to the southeast of Jerusalem, in what's the northeastern Negev, a fortress, and in that fortress was an Israelite temple. That Israelite temple had a sacrificial altar. It had been there since the days of Solomon. But it's interesting, the archaeologists discovered that during the time of Hezekiah, the altar went out of use, and it was covered over, completely covered over. And so, archaeologically, we have been able to prove this is indeed what Hezekiah did. He took away these altars. And so Sennacherib is saying, how can you expect this God of yours to help you, seeing that you have prevented the people of Judah and Jerusalem from worshiping all over the country and said, no, if you want to worship Yahweh, you have to come here to Jerusalem. You think your God is going to be pleased with that? He's going to help you after having done that? He says, now therefore I urge you, give a pledge to my master, the king of Assyria, and I will give you 2,000 horses if you're able on your part to put riders on them. But how will you repel one captain of the least of my master's servants and put your trust in Egypt for chariots and horsemen? He's repeating that trust about Egypt being an unreliable ally. Have I now come up without the Eternal against this place to destroy it? The Eternal said to me, go up against this land and destroy it. That's, of course, quite a vain statement. Then we find an interesting response. Now, that's good psychological warfare, though. Think about the impact. You've got the three top Assyrian officials down there below the wall. You've got the three top ones of Judah on the top of the wall. And they're yelling back and forth this business. And think of the content of what these three Assyrian officials are saying. They're saying, remember, lots of other people are gathered on the wall to listen to what's going on. And the Assyrians are saying, look, are you trusting in the Egyptian armies? Yeah, we gave them the rout. There's no way Egypt can give you any help. Your soldiers are incompetent against ours. We could, you know, even the least of ours could defeat your soldiers. And if you say you're trusting in your God, I mean, why should your God help you? One, Hezekiah has closed the altars to many of the altars to your God. And it was your God himself who told us we should come up and take this country and conquer it. Everybody's getting an earful. Ooh. Now, this sounds really bad. And so that explains the next verse. Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, Shebna, and Yoah said to the Rabshakeh, please speak to your servants in the Aramaic language, for we understand it. But don't speak to us in Hebrew in the hearing of the people who are on the wall. In other words, stop conducting this discussion in Hebrew, which everybody is listening to. Let's talk a language they don't understand. You know, we're educated. We understand Aramaic, the lingua franca of the day. If you go today, what's the lingua franca in most of the world, at least in the world of business and science, it's English. You go back to the earlier part of the 20th century or the 19th century, you know, it would be French. It was the dominant language among educated people in the West. Aramaic was the similar lingua franca of the day. So they're saying, look, let's continue now to discuss this in some language that people won't hear. Why do they want to make that request? Because they already see the psychological damage that's being done to the people on the wall as they hear these Assyrians speak. The people are really buzzing and worried and concerned, and they don't want a lot of public pressure to build for a capitulation to the Assyrians. And so they make this request. This is very much human drama that we can relate to. We can understand this if we take the time to read this and think about it as if it was just going on right in front of us. But the Rav Sheker said to them, "Has my master sent me to your master and just you to speak these words, and not to the men who sit on the wall? Aren't they going to share your fate, whatever it is? Don't they have a right to hear it?" You know, they're doing this deliberately. So the Rav Sheker stood and called out with a loud voice in Hebrew, saying, "Hear the word of the great king, the king of Assyria. Thus says the king, do not let Hezekiah deceive you, for he shall not be able to deliver you from his hand. Nor let Hezekiah make you trust in the Eternal, saying, the Eternal will surely deliver us. This city shall not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Don't listen to Hezekiah. For thus says the king of Assyria, make peace with me by a tribute payment, and come out to me, and every one of you will eat from his own vine, and every one from his own fig tree, and every one of you will drink waters of his own cistern." You mean he's just going to let him go? No. Follow the next verse. "Until I come and take you away to a land like your own land, a land of grain and new wine, a land of bread and vineyards, a land of olive groves and honey, that you may live and not die." In other words, what is he offering them if they surrender? Just to leave them alone? No. He's offering them exile. He's saying, you'll keep your lives, but you will go into exile, and the place we put you in is not going to be terrible. It'll be like what you've got here. So why keep listening to this King Hezekiah and resisting us? Because if we have to take the city by force, well, then your lives will be forfeit. He says, don't listen to Hezekiah, lest he persuade you by saying the Eternal will deliver us. Has any of the gods of the nations at all delivered its land from the hand of the king of Assyria? In other words, hey, is there any nation that has ever stood before us? Isn't it obvious we are invincible? We cannot be stopped. We cannot be defeated. Where are the gods of Hamath and Arpad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim and Hena and Iva? Indeed, have they delivered Samaria from my hand? Who among all the gods of the lands have delivered their countries from my hand, that the Eternal should deliver Jerusalem from my hand? But the people held their peace and answered him not a word, because the king had given commandment, don't say anything. Keep your mouth shut. Don't say anything. And then Eliakim the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, Shebna the scribe, and Yoah the son of Asaph the recorder, came to Hezekiah with their clothes torn, which is a symbol of what? Mourning. And told him the words of the Rabshakeh. And so it was, when King Hezekiah heard it, he tore his clothes, covered himself with sackcloth, and went into the house of the Eternal. And he sent Eliakim, who was over the household, Shebna the scribe, and the elders of the priest, covered with sackcloth, to Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amos. And they said to him, thus says Hezekiah, this day is a day of trouble and rebuke and blasphemy, for the children have come to birth, but there is no strength to bring them forth. It may be that the Eternal your God will hear all the words of the Rabshakeh, whom his master the king of Assyria has sent to reproach the living God, and will reprove the words which the Eternal your God has heard. Therefore lift up your prayer for the remnant that is left. In other words, Hezekiah still held hope that God would not sit still for such blasphemy of his name, and he might yet save them for his own name's sake, if not for Judah's. He says, maybe we're not worthy, but maybe God will act to defend his own reputation. So the servants of King Hezekiah came to Isaiah, and Isaiah said to them, thus shall you say to your master, thus says the Eternal, do not be afraid of the words which you have heard, with which the servants of the king of Assyria have blasphemed me. Surely I will send a spirit upon him, and he shall hear a rumor and return to his own land, and I will cause him to fall by the sword in his own land. Now, interestingly enough, Isaiah didn't come personally. Interestingly enough. Remember in the days of Ahaz, Hezekiah's father, Isaiah was told by God to go personally and talk to Ahaz. This time he sends the message back through Hezekiah's own servants. The implication there is that God expected that there still was faith in Hezekiah, and that even getting the message secondhand would be sufficient. Well, Hezekiah had to make a tough decision. The terms offered might not have been the best, but they were at least for the welfare of the people. If he stuck to it and held out and it went bad, on his conscience would be all the deaths of the people that would have been needless. But he's in the leadership role. He's got to take the heat. He has to make that decision upon which lives, innocent lives, will depend. Well, what did Hezekiah do? Hezekiah stayed put. He had the faith to stay put. And you have a very beautiful prayer in chapter 19, which he prayed. We won't take time to read that. But where did this faith come from? Of course, faith ultimately is a gift of God. But it has to be able to take root. And it takes root when a person has been exercising faith on a daily basis in small things. Then the faith that we seek from God for the tough times can take root in us, and we can be established in it. And Hezekiah was. Now, there was an unfortunate consequence of God's delivering Jerusalem, because we know what happened. God sent a plague. The army surrounding Jerusalem was decimated, and very close in time to that, Sennacherib heard a rumor that required his presence back in Assyria, because it looked like his empire was in trouble, and he rushed back with his army. And shortly after that, his own sons rose up in rebellion against him, and one of them assassinated him even while he was praying before his own God in Assyria. So he came to a very unfortunate end. But there was an unfortunate follow-up in terms of the mentality of the people of Jerusalem. Unfortunately, they drew the wrong lesson from God's deliverance of the city. Why had God decided to deliver the city from what we've read in the scripture? Right? And why else? Right. Because of Hezekiah's faith and faithfulness. It wasn't just the faith of Hezekiah alone, but he had been a faithful servant of God. He had tried to do that which was right in God's sight. That's why God acted to save the city. Unfortunately, the people of Jerusalem didn't draw that lesson. They made a very bad assumption. Just like the Israelites back there in the days of Eli, when they took the ark into battle. The people of Jerusalem mistakenly assumed that Jerusalem was spared because God had to spare Jerusalem. God could let every city of Judah be conquered by the enemy, but God could not let Jerusalem be conquered. Because if Jerusalem was conquered, what would suffer? God's temple. God's temple would be destroyed. And since God could not let his temple be destroyed, God had to save Jerusalem. That was the lesson they learned, unfortunately. And that was to be the source of trouble at the end of the history of the independent nation of Judah. Because when the Babylonians later were to surround the city and demanded surrender, the people refused to surrender, not because they had such faith in God and faith in they were doing the things God was pleased with, but they had faith, a blind, dead faith, that God couldn't let the city of Jerusalem be taken, else the temple would be destroyed. And as much as Jeremiah was inspired of God to warn them that that was a broken reed on which to lean. They couldn't believe it. They refused to believe it. Because they kept thinking, Jeremiah says, he's speaking for God when he says, you can't trust in the temple, you know, for our security. Just the physical presence of the temple. But God did spare the city in the days of Hezekiah because of the temple. So Jeremiah must be wrong. Jeremiah must not be really speaking for God. Notice that in Jeremiah's message, though we're jumping ahead time-wise now from 701 to 586. Notice this in Jeremiah chapter 7. Jeremiah chapter 7. God instructed Jeremiah to stand in the gate of the temple and to deliver this message. Jeremiah 7 verse 3. Thus says the Eternal of Hosts, the God of Israel, amend your ways and your doings, and I will cause you to dwell in this place. You say you want to remain safe and secure in Jerusalem? Well, if you change your way of life, which is contrary to my law, and begin to live the way of life prescribed by my law, then I will cause you to dwell here in safety. But do not trust in these lying words, saying the temple of the eternal, the temple of the eternal, the temple of the eternal are these. God calls that statement lying words. He says in verse 12, go now to my place which was in Shiloh, where I set my name at the first, and see what I did to it because of the wickedness of my people Israel. He's saying, let that be an example. In those days, the tabernacle was there. And I didn't prevent that place from being destroyed just because the tabernacle was there. Learn the lesson that I don't respect places. I'm more interested in righteousness. And if there's no righteousness, I won't protect a place just because something is there which you consider holy. He says in verse 13, now because you have done all these works, and I spoke to you rising up early and speaking, but you didn't hear, and I called to you, but you didn't answer, therefore I will do to this house, which is called by my name, in which you trust, and to this place which I gave to you and your fathers, as I have done to Shiloh. But the people didn't believe that this message really came from God. They said, oh, Jeremiah, that's just your opinion. That can't be right. I mean, God spared the city back there in the days of Hezekiah. He has to spare it now. We don't have to listen to you. And, of course, that ended in disaster. Okay, let's go back now to the time of Hezekiah. Hezekiah was blessed in his later life because when he was very ill, God gave him extra years because of his faithfulness. But Hezekiah was followed by a man on the throne who was not of the same stripe. His son Manasseh polluted the worship of Judah, probably far worse than any king who had ever ruled in Judah. He rebuilt the high places of Baal. He worshipped the whole host of heaven. It was fantastically evil. And Judah again fell under the Assyrian whip, and indeed Manasseh was imprisoned. And although he repented, he was allowed to be restored to his throne shortly before his death. And now we come down to the time of King Josiah. King Josiah was like King Hezekiah. King Josiah, I'm skipping over Amon, who was Josiah's father, because nothing of great importance happened in his reign. In the case of King Josiah, we have a man who was like Hezekiah. He also set out from the very beginning to do that which was right in God's sight. In 2 Chronicles chapter 34, 2 Chronicles chapter 34, We read in verse 2, he did that which was right in the sight of the Eternal and walked in the ways of his father David. He did not turn aside to the right hand or to the left. For in the eighth year of his reign, while he was still young, he began to seek the God of his father. And in the 12th year, he began to purge Judah and Jerusalem of the high places, the wooden images, the carved images, and the molded images. He broke down the altars of the Baals in his presence, and the incense altars which were above them he cut down. The wooden images, the carved images, the molded images he broke in pieces and made dust of them, and scattered them on the graves of those who had sacrificed to them. Notice he even carried this reform northward in verse 6. He thoroughly cleansed the country both north and south as far as he could reach. Now, how was it possible for Josiah to actively penetrate northward and destroy all these pagan places or corrupt Yahwehistic places? The answer lies in the fact that Assyria was weak. Assyria was in its final decline, just short of its ultimate collapse. In fact, within 10 years, Assyria's major cities would be captured by the Babylonians. This is around 625 BC. In 612, Nineveh was to fall, and along with Nineveh, a number of the other major Assyrian cities. So Assyria was in its final decline. There was no way the Assyrians could retaliate against what Josiah was doing. Now we have found again in Arad, that same temple that existed there, Hezekiah had taken the altar, the sacrificial altar, out of use, but he had left the sanctuary intact, and he had left incense altars there. We find archaeologically that in the days of Josiah, even the temple itself with the incense altars was put out of use. And so the reform of Josiah even went further than the reforms of Hezekiah. In chapter 35, we read that Josiah kept a Passover to the Eternal in Jerusalem. He had repaired the temple of the Lord. And in the repairing of the temple of the Lord and refurbishing it, he found a copy of the Book of the Law. And, of course, was very upset to see how far they had strayed from the practices that God had commanded. And so he had reinstituted the teaching of God's law. And he set himself to keep the Passover in Jerusalem. Notice also, in verse 3, he said to the Levites who taught all Israel that they should put the holy ark in the house which Solomon the son of David had built, and to prepare themselves, you know, for this great occasion. But notice he also offered the people of the north an opportunity to participate in this great event. Because we find here that if we come to verse 17, that the children of Israel who were present kept the Passover at the time, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, for 7 days. There had been no Passover kept in Israel like that since the days of Samuel the prophet. None of the kings of Israel had kept such a Passover as Josiah kept, with the priests, the Levites, all Judah and Israel who were present, and the inhabitants of Jerusalem. When he had sent out messengers to solicit contributions for the repair of the temple, we find this back in 2 Chronicles chapter 34. He also sent his messengers north. He also sent them north. And there was a response from the northerners as well. You can look at it later. So we still have mention of the remnant of the people of the north who are still there, and some of them who refused perhaps to turn to God in the days of Hezekiah decided to turn towards God in the days of Josiah. Now Josiah was a righteous king. He did a lot of good. He repaired the temple of God. He reinstituted the operation of God's law among the people. He rid the country of all forms of pagan worship or corrupt Yahweh worship. He even cleansed much of the northern kingdom of their remnants of pagan worship. But yet, he also was capable of making a mistake. We read in chapter 35 of 2 Chronicles verse 20, that after all this, when Josiah had prepared the temple, Necho, the king of Egypt, came up to fight against Carchemish by the Euphrates. Now, the Bible doesn't explain what Pharaoh Necho was doing. We have to look to secular history to find out. It was not just an attempt by the Egyptians to make a land grab or something. The Assyrians, we've moved forward in time. It says, after all this. The great reform and great Passover of Josiah was around 625. We've now moved down to 609 B.C. Nineveh has fallen. Other major Assyrian cities have fallen. There is only a remnant of the Assyrian power left. The Assyrian king has retreated from Assyria proper. He has established a headquarters in the city of Haran. The city of Haran, the city where, remember, Laban used to dwell. There is practically nothing left of the Assyrian power. It is a, smoldering stump of a torch that's left, out ready to go out. The Babylonians have decided to attack this remnant of Assyrian power and totally destroy it. Pharaoh Necho has decided this is not in his best interest. He does not want to see Babylon getting too powerful. And so Pharaoh Necho is rushing through Palestine on his way to the Euphrates River to try to strengthen the Assyrians, so that the Babylonians will not win a decisive victory. This is his game plan. Assyrian power has collapsed. That has created a vacuum in the Near East. Who is going to fill that vacuum? The Babylonians are trying to. If Pharaoh Necho can take his army up there to the Euphrates and stiffen the Assyrian resistance, check the Babylonians, the Babylonians will not be able to grab any territory west of the Euphrates. And so Pharaoh Necho can. That's his game plan. He's hoping, not because he loves the Assyrians, but because if he can prop up the Assyrians enough so they can stop the Babylonians, that the Babylonians can grab everything east of the Euphrates and he can have everything west of the Euphrates, including the vital trade routes of Palestine and Syria. This is what Pharaoh Necho is seeking to accomplish. But Josiah went out against Pharaoh Necho. He tried to stop Pharaoh Necho, if not totally prevent him from reaching the Euphrates. He was trying to at least weaken him sufficiently so when he got to the Euphrates, he would not be able to help the Assyrians enough. He wanted the Babylonians to win. In other words, Josiah was trying to prevent the Egyptian king Necho from preventing the Babylonians from conquering the Assyrians decisively. Now, what was in Josiah's mind, we cannot say for sure. It is possible, and I know I'm speculating, that Josiah was trying to assist the Babylonians in this regard, hoping that when the Babylonians won, he would be rewarded with an enlarged role over all Israelite territory, both north and south, and that would put him in a position to dominate the area, just like Solomon had, just like Ahab and Jehoshaphat had, just like Jeroboam II and Uzziah had. There would be another great golden age of Israelite prosperity under his rule if he was able to significantly help the Babylonians. Anyway, Pharaoh Necho was inspired by God to warn him off. But Josiah wasn't quite sure that really God was speaking through Pharaoh Necho. But he wasn't sure he wasn't. And so did something very, very foolish. He disguised himself and went into the battle at Megiddo not as the king but as an ordinary soldier. But the message was from God. And so as it says here in verse 23, the archers shot King Josiah. Now, he, despite the fact that he had disguised himself, and I think the old King James, it says, at a venture, he drew the bow. In other words, he wasn't particularly aiming at Josiah. He just aimed it in the general direction of the Israelites and shot it. And the arrow found its way to Josiah. Josiah was mortally wounded. He was taken back to Jerusalem, where he died. And the people, of course, greatly mourned the death of Josiah because they saw him as a man who had wanted them to prosper by returning them to the proper ways of God. And we'll bring this lecture to a close at this point.